Okay, our next presenter is Ted Miller. He's a safety economist and operations research analyst who works at the Pacific Center for Research and Evaluation, and there he directs SAMHSA's Prescription Abuse Workplace Technical Assistance Program.
Thank you, sir. And I have nothing to disclose. If you look at the molecular structure of oxycodone or hydrocodone or any of the prescription pain relievers, they look almost like heroin. They're just twisted a little. And what we've seen in the last few years is that deaths from these things are just shooting up and up and up. And we now have prescription overdose exceeding motor vehicle crashes, the number one cause of injury death in this country. And prescription opioids now have also, in states like Tennessee, passed marijuana as the drug of choice. And the reason is your health insurance won't help pay for your grass. It's also easier for teens to get their hands on prescription drugs than marijuana. A prescription of oxycodone for the month, OxyContin, can be 120 pills. Street price, $14.50 a pill, that's $1,750 in one bottle of pills. There's some real problems with theft. 80% of workers' comp injury claims include at least one prescription opioid. These things are highly addictive. You get OxyContin, you get withdrawal symptoms in 5 days. So on day six, you stop it because you figure you're done with the pain. You start getting nauseous. The dentist gave you a 30-day supply. He knows that it's safe, so you go back to taking them. By 30 days, you're addicted. Given their price, if you're prescribed one, you ought to spend $20 on a medicine cabinet lockbox. And that's what that is. And we now know that if you have a co-prescription for naloxone, if you pass out because of your oxycodone or your other morphine derivative, they can revive you by shooting that into your nose. And anybody, a trained family member, can do that. Many of the people who are dying taking their prescribed dose. We've seen in states where they've gone to carrying oxycodone by the police, naltrexone, that they're administering, they're saving 1,000 lives in a year in one state. It's unbelievable how much of this there is. As Sue mentioned, we're funded by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. You'll find on one side of your handout that's at the back there and that I gave out to most people that we have a free weekly uplist of what's happening in the literature, both in the journal literature and in the newspapers. And it lets you, if you're working this issue, it's really worth it. It's free. And we've also got, through our partnership with West Virginia University Injury Control Center, you can search the back issues, which means an easy way to search the literature on this topic. And there's 16 fact sheets up there that aren't available anywhere else at the moment. The big issue is with this epidemic, how do we respond? When somebody's managing their pain and they get addicted and they still have the pain, so they still need it. When kids have Skittle parties, you grab whatever looks like fun out of the medicine cabinet, you bring it over to somebody's house, you mix them all together in a bowl, you take a spoonful, you wash them down with alcohol. When they get you to the emergency department, nobody has any idea what you just ingested. The federal response has been to label it an epidemic, to label it a prescription drug abuse crisis, to put together a national plan. And one of the things the states have tried is a bunch of prescription monitoring programs. Every state but Missouri, they all look different. In some sense, they collect electronically transmitted prescription data from prescribers or from pharmacies or from both. There are a few states that mandate participation, but most don't as yet. Some are law enforcement oriented, some are public health oriented. And they all let prescribers and dispensers check patient history of prescription use and whether they're getting other already addictive drugs from somebody else. But they're not mandated to use it. The people with financial incentives to want to use it, Medicaid in a few states is allowed to. In no state are private health plan case managers, pharmacy managers, fraud control, or medical review officers in workplaces. So the medical review officer has no idea whether the person is using a legitimate drug and whether they're getting it from more than one source. A thousand flowers are starting to bloom of what do we do about a national epidemic. I tried to organize those in the Haddon Matrix. The Haddon Matrix was developed for motor vehicle. It was then applied to violence. It has pre-event, during the event, and post-event. I define during the event as being while somebody is taking a potentially abusable substance, but not yet known to others who might intervene to be having a problem. There's a host, an agent. I define the agent as either the drug or the prescription needed to get it. And then following Sue Baker and Carol Runyon's breakout of the Haddon Matrix, I define the social and physical environments. And this is on your handout, so it's easier to follow along. For the host, we start out pre-event with education programs. I mentioned pregnancy education separately here because we're now finding thousands of babies being born a year in this country dependent on prescription drugs, and particularly prescription opiates. Scary. You need self-assessment tools for people while they're taking so they can realize they have a problem. We need to be co-prescribing naloxone where we're doing that. That's a proven intervention now. And of course, we need brief intervention and treatment. When it comes to the agent, we're starting to modify some of these drugs. We've now got OxyContin, so if you grind it up or if you try to dissolve it so you can really get a high out of it, it stops working. It's really miracle chemistry. At the same time, last week, FDA approved a new hydrocodone. It's more powerful than anything on the market that doesn't have that abuse protection. It's crazy they're speaking out both sides of their mouth at once. At the same day, they moved hydrocodone to Schedule 2, which means it's harder to prescribe it. Some states have gone to secure prescription pads so you can't as easily forge a prescription. Some states are now experimenting with electronic health records where the electronic health record moves the prescription to the pharmacy without it going through the patient's hands. I think we need a package warning that just in big print says this substance is addictive, and it is deadly. And I think we need both the dispensers and the prescribers explicitly warning the recipients about that, and they're not. We also need disposal instructions that are clear and immediate. And there are a few counties now where they're actually making and it's going to go through the courts, but they're saying that you have to pay for disposal as part of the price of the drug. A prescription monitoring programs are defense against the agent while this is ongoing, and you could say that maybe that was the host. There has been suggestions to pay MDs to check the prescription monitoring program, pay them $3. We don't know yet if that'll work. There are a couple states that proactively are doing patient reports saying, hey doc, your patient is getting prescription pain relievers from four sources, just making you aware. That does work. It's effective. ED case managers are effective where they've been tried, who make sure that that you're not serving a high flyer when they come through the ED. And the other thing they're very effectively doing in some EDs now is limiting prescriptions. Prescription opioid out of the ED, 7 to 15 day supply, must be filled within 3 days, may not be refilled, makes a big difference. We need a lot of theft safeguards out there because the thefts are occurring. We need to dispose of the unused drugs. If you've been detected as having a problem, they're finding evidence-based now, put you on just one dispenser and one prescriber, and that, along with some monitoring through regular testing by your physician, can actually be protective. A very good piece of news is that some of our youth substance abuse prevention programs, family strengthening program, either alone or in conjunction with All Stars Life Skills Training or Project Alert, looked back longitudinally and discovered that they actually had an effect on prescription drug abuse of the kids who have been through them. When we get to the physical environment, one of the big questions is health insurance. We know that prescription opiates are 20% effective against pain. Mindful meditation is 20% effective against pain. Massage is 20% effective against lower back pain. Acupuncture is maybe 15% effective against lower back pain. Non-prescription analgesics are 20% effective against lower back pain. Why is our health insurance only covering the one that's addictive? Why is that the one that we're prescribing first? It's crazy. We need to start requiring in more states use of the prescription monitoring programs. I'm ready to move that close to some evidence-based intervention at least. Another thing we've seen that does work is proactively monitoring providers through those programs and dispensers and notifying either law enforcement or notifying the medical society, hey, this prescriber is prescribing 50 prescriptions an hour for this drug. There's a problem. Random testing is a real question. Random testing means that your employer has just tested you for this prescription drug. Medical review officer is sitting there saying, oh, well, they're on it legally. I can't tell their employer about their health problem. That violates their privacy. But that drug has a label on it, do not operate heavy machinery. They drive a company car. I have to somehow intervene. It's a very difficult issue. We've started putting take-back programs all over the country, these drop boxes. The first piece of evidence base I've seen is a simulation that says that it, at least if we get enough back, should start to impair supply and reduce recreational spread. We're seeing screeners developed that can be used to screen for people. We need poison control centers on the job to deal with overdose, needle exchange. We need, when somebody overdoses, to trace the drug source, to prosecute the dealers, deal with the pill mills. Our substance abuse prevention programs have some evidence of at least correlation. Drug-free workplace policies and programs do correlate with reduced prescription abuse. We need to train the providers. A lot of the problem here is the people who are prescribing it don't understand the dangers, don't understand prescribe, and the dental guidelines are hopeless. We need some media campaigns to educate people. We need our surveillance, our research, our analysis and evaluation of data, our communities mobilized. We need families watching. One thing they found was that naloxone was great, except for that if you called 911, which you have to do after administering it, you could be prosecuted if you gave the person a pill. So a bunch of states have now started immunizing there, and it remains to be seen whether that works. We also need families supporting people as they go into recovery. But part of the problem is nothing settled in many of these areas. If we should we flush controlled substances? The pros are it's easy, it's certain, you can't recover it. But it damages the environment. And it doesn't work to say, flush your naltrexone, not flush your prescription opiate, don't flush your metformin. Because now we've got confused health education messages. I recommend if you've got a program, the Connecticut Disposal Fact Sheet, which I think is a good one. We have no idea what to do about the internet and cell phones as facilitators. We do know that there are lots of apps out there that let you identify whether the pill you're buying on the street is the drug you think it is. We know that there's some hope for the public health approach to find the problem, identify risk and protective factors, develop and test prevention strategies, and ensure widespread adoption. That was used in Project Lazarus in North Carolina, which is now evidence-based and it's starting to be replicated. They came up with a whole range of things using toolkits and face-to-face meetings to educate primary care providers about safe prescribing, about managing pain, educate patients and families on opioid safety, teach them how to handle overdoses with naloxone. They've moved into ED case managers. They pioneered that, the prescription limits, into treatment. They decreased deaths by 69% while not reducing total opiates prescribed. We have lots of fact sheets out on that website about the dangers of prescription opiates. about theft, things like telling realtors, when you tell people to lock up their valuables, the prescription drugs are one of the big valuables. Telling people shopping in the grocery store, don't drop your paid-for prescription drug in the shopping cart and turn your back on it because somebody can grab it and walk out of the store and you're stuck. Information for employers. What can you ask? Why shouldn't you, for employees, why shouldn't you share drugs at work? Reasons ranging from, that's drug dealing, you can be fired, to that's something that you're liable for if the person has a problem. We're doing one on data sources on prescription abuse. We're doing another one on how to scan hospital discharge data to identify prescription abuse cases. We're doing some case studies on what workplaces are doing. In summary, the evidence base is improving, but much remains unproven. We've got an increasing ability to provide prevention and early intervention. Environmental strategies seem compelling. Coalition models do seem applicable. Workplaces, we think, are key for addressing the issues of employees and their families. And most of the people who are dying here are adults, not kids. It's an unusual form of drug abuse or poisoning injury in that sense. We find that their collaboration with workplaces is promising. There's something called SmartRx, which is a health thing on websites that works. It's a wellness program. Multimedia approaches have a very far reach, especially with youth, and we think we need to move there. I've got time left to give you one last interesting factoid, and that's that when you look at alcohol, you find that more than half of the alcohol is consumed by 7% of the drinkers. With prescription opiates, it's even more concentrated. Well over half of the prescription opiates are consumed by well less than 10% of the users. We're seeing widely this slide that most people got their opiates from one source, but if you go back and you reanalyze that slide with the percentage who are using most of the opiates, I think we're going to get a very different answer. Thank you.